Are you a helicopter parent? Or do you resent that description? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with a guest this hour who says helicopter parents are not doing their children any favors, that they're really doing more harm than good. While so-called helicopter parents may just want their children to be successful in life, our guest says that what they're doing is just the opposite. We will welcome your thoughts and questions for the author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Julie Lithcott-Hames is a former dean of freshman and undergraduate advising at Stanford University. She has spoken and written widely on the phenomenon of helicopter parenting, with her work appearing on TEDx Talks and in Forbes and the Chicago Tribune. She is, as mentioned, the author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks so much for having me back in Wisconsin.
Welcome back to Wisconsin. What is your Wisconsin connection?
I lived in Middleton, Wisconsin for high school. I went to Middleton High School, class of 85. I actually also lived in Madison for a couple of years when I was an elementary schooler. So I've been living in California for half my life, but Wisconsin is definitely where my roots are.
Oh, that's great. So did your parents raise you in Wisconsin as a free-range kid, or were they helicopter parents?
Well, it was the 70s and early 80s, so I think you know the answer. It was free-range. We didn't call it free-range, of course, then. It was just how parents raised kids. You know, parents back in those days weren't anywhere near as fearful about the world or about a child's chances for making it in the world. You know, we let our kids, let childhood do much of the teaching, whereas today we parents think, boy, we've got to overprotect, provide a lot of direction, do a lot of hand-holding just so that they'll make it. And it turns out there's a lot of harm that comes from that.
Yeah, and we will talk about that harm, but describe for us the helicopter parent. How do you define helicopter parenting?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of terms out there, like helicopter parent, tiger parent, free range, snowplow. We've put a lot of labels on parenting types, and I think it's more helpful to examine the actual behavior. So the first type is the tendency to overprotect. This is the parent who feels, you know, the world is scary and unsafe, and therefore I must try to protect you from everything, prevent everything from happening, rather than prepare you for what's going to be hard and challenging about the world. The second type is the over-directing type. This is a.k.a. the tiger mom or tiger dad, the person who says, I know best what will lead to your success, and you will follow my direction. So this is the parent that wants to decide what schools, which classes to take, what to major in, when they go to college, which career and profession, and so on. And often takes a very harsh approach to that guidance. The third type is the overhelper. This parent acts as the kid's concierge or personal assistant or secretary or handler. This is the parent that just wants to smooth the path and talk to, you know, the adults, the coaches, the referees, the principals, the teachers, to really sort of intervene or make sure, fills out the forms, make sure the deadlines are met, and so on. So helicopter parenting really falls down into one, two, or all three of those types.
Well, it's good to know. So, yeah, it's overparenting. The subtitle of your book is maybe the
That's right. The
umbrella term.
That's right. And, you know, Joy, let me also say, before we go any farther, I'm a mom. I have two teenagers. I have a 14-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old son. And, you know, back in my early days as freshman dean at Stanford, I saw more and more parents coming to campus. This was the early 2000s, with their young adults, son and daughter, and wanting to still play a life in the university, in the life of their son or daughter while they were at university, which was unusual in the early 2000s. You know, prior to that point, we'd been accustomed to 18 through 22-year-olds being able to, relatively speaking, conduct their business at the university and do what needed to be done. But the early 2000s, we saw more and more parents coming. and wanting to do the work for their kids, not necessarily literally the homework, but handling the transactions of university life or contesting a grade that was lower than expected or dealing with a roommate problem or just getting more information on opportunities. I was pretty critical of those parents in the early years, but around about 2009, I had just come home from giving a big talk to parents of Stanford freshmen where I said, okay, folks, trust your kid. Trust the university. Now, please go home. And this was, that sort of message at the start of the school year. And then I came home and realized I was still cutting my own kids' meat, and they were 8 and 10 years old. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I'm on track to be one of those parents who can't let go at 18 because I'm enabling their dependence on me here at 8 and 10, and I'm supposed to be building their independence. So that was my wake-up call and made me really quite compassionate toward parents who are only trying to do their very best, but who are overhelping, and that leads to harm.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think happened? In terms of when we were college kids, we were get the heck out of the house and do it all yourself. To what's happening today? What happened?
Well, a couple things happened. First of all, we're talking about the early 1980s when all of this began. Stranger Danger was born, a couple of very tragic, highly publicized cases of child abduction in the nation were brought to our national attention. And really from that moment on, right around 82, 83, we began to fear this occurrence and act as if it was possible any moment, any time. We began putting kids' faces on the back of milk cartons and lumping in runaways and custodial dispute situations with actual cases of stranger abduction, which are actually very, very rare. So despite the fact that the numbers are incredibly small, we began to fear it as a nation. Our mindset was, boy, stranger danger is something we have to always be on the constant watch out, look out for. So stranger danger number two, the play date, was born in 1984. Moms were going back to work and dads weren't exactly coming home. Who was going to be there for the kids to play with one another? So, parents began scheduling play. Maybe that was a practical reality, but then they began hovering over play, wanting to tell kids how to play, wanting to intervene when kids weren't getting along, and so on. The third thing is a self-esteem movement was born also in the early 80s. This was the sense that, hey, it's important to give a kid, recognition just for showing up. This is the everyone gets a trophy generation being born. Certificates, ribbons, trophies, the only people that benefited from those things actually were the certificate, ribbon, and trophy right. manufacturers, Joy, And then finally, A Nation at Risk was published. This was a book that said our teenagers here in America aren't faring as well academically vis-a-vis their international counterparts, and we needed more testing and more teaching to the test. So all told, we had parents involved in play and in, youth sports and in education, and really just with kids out on sidewalks and parks and in the street, hovering over their lives, their childhood in ways that were really unprecedented. The final piece I'll add is this was the baby boom who first began parenting this way, a generation of people who were so great about demanding their own right to be heard as teenagers and young adults really changed some of the fundamental paradigms of American society when they were teens and young adults, questioned authority every step of the way. As they became parents, they continued to question authority, but now on behalf of their sons or daughters. And the great irony is, while they were so hell-bent on creating their own self-actualization as humans, they actually ended up undercutting their own kids' chances to achieve that, healthy sense of I can do this for myself.
Yeah. Well, and what caught our eye first about your work was an article in Slate where you talked about how over-parenting was making college students depressed. Talk about how you noticed this.
Yeah. When I first wrote on this phenomenon, it was 2005, and I was, someone who'd been a college dean for a handful of years. I worked with so many young adults, and I just saw them still scanning the sidelines for mom or dad to tell them what to do or how to do it. It's the kind of thing that's cute if someone's 5, but when they're 20 and you see this kind of what I call existential impotence, the sense of I can't make a decision, I can't, solve a problem, I can't, I can't make my way through life without, mom or dad really constantly being by my side, you begin to worry, as I did, what's it going to mean for that young man or woman And given that it's the millennial generation, now the largest in American history, what's that going to mean for us as a as an American society that's going to need the millennials to really take the mantle of leadership from Gen X one day and you know, in a not-so-distant day? So back when I wrote my first piece in 2005 for the Chicago Tribune, actually, you know, I just had my hunches that this didn't feel right. 10 years later, you know, How to Raise an Adult is out, my book on the subject, and in the last 3 or 4 years, study after study have come out from the field of psychology linking over-parenting with greater rates of depression and anxiety in adolescents and young adults. These studies were no surprise to me, Joy. I was actually thrilled when they came out because it confirmed this hunch, this sort of feeling that I had had. Of course, I'm not thrilled that it's happening. It's devastating. You know, with the best of intentions, we parents are doing too much for our kids. They end up not doing, thinking, or being for themselves when we're constantly attending their every moment, trying to cultivate their every afternoon, you know, into some form of excellence toward some definition of success. You know, we end up actually depriving them of the chance to develop a healthy psychological self. And lately, you know, studies are saying, yep, that's exactly what's happening.
We are talking about the downsides of over-parenting. And we are welcoming your questions and maybe your observations for our guest, Julie Lithcott-Hames, former Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford University. She has spoken and written widely on the phenomenon of helicopter parenting. And she is the author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network. So do you know someone you would consider a helicopter parent, someone who is way over-involved in their child's life? Our guest this hour says that over-involved parents are often harming their children, not helping them. And she will offer advice on how to raise an adult. Julie Lithcott-Hames is the author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org if you'd like to weigh in with a question or maybe an example or maybe a challenge. Victor in West Allis is with us. Hello, Victor.
Hi, Joy. Enjoy your program.
Thanks.
Hey, I'm 7 years old, so I've been around for a while. I'm getting to wonder, even with your beautiful programs you have, like a couple of a while back you had about colleges, and I wonder where the news media may be at fault, saying, hey, if you go to this college, you know, it's this amount of money. If you go to this course, it won't pay you any money. And I think parents are maybe overprotective, like you said, but I think what's happening, we're being bombarded so much with such negative stuff, and parents are concerned.
Yeah,
Victor. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Julie.
I jumped right in. Sorry, Joy. Victor, yeah, thanks for your call and thanks for saying that. I think as parents, we're definitely bombarded with a narrow slice of information. We all know that it's the negative stories that seem at least to make the TV news. Radio tends to be more thoughtful and more wide in scope. And so, absolutely, to your point, we parents need to be better educated about, you know, what the real opportunities are and what the real risks are. You know, one example is in many communities around the nation, we seem to think that there are only a handful of colleges that we can be really proud for our kid to attend. You know, the truth is there are 2,800 colleges and universities in the United States that offer a four-year education, not to mention the great community colleges that offer a two-year education. And I like to say that, as with anything, the top 5% are probably fantastic. That's 140 schools, including, of course, the great University of Wisconsin system. So, you know, we need to pull back our blinders about the reality and not be spoon-fed information, you know, by the media or by, you know, neighbors who think they have the answer to everything. Fundamentally, we got to trust our own values, trust our, you know, our own selves, raise our own kids and, you know, do embrace the kid we have in front of us, not try to make them into something, you know, someone else thinks they should be.
Yeah. You know, Victor also told my producer that, you know, he thinks that we're given tons of advice on how to raise children. Lots of experts say, hey, get more involved in your child's life. Maybe your child would do better academically if you, you know, paid attention to homework and the like. But then now we're being scolded that we're over-parenting. You want to comment on that?
Well, yeah, Joy, absolutely. You know, we parents can feel like we can never do anything right because experts all over the place, including now me, you know, seem to be telling us to do precisely the opposite of what we thought we were supposed to do. Here's where I'm going to get a little philosophical with you and with your listeners. If you think about it, we're mammals. So I like to say we're mammals with clothing and a cell phone, but we're still mammals. And that means we want to raise our offspring to the point where they can fend for themselves in the world without us. For humans, that takes about 18 or 20 years, usually. The point is, our job as parents is to put ourselves out of a job. And if we'll acknowledge that that's really, you know, we can feel we've succeeded when our, you know, son or daughter has that capacity to fend for themselves, then we have to appreciate that childhood is meant to prepare them for that inevitable moment when we're gone and they're going to make their way on their own and maybe even raise their own kids one day. If you accept that, then you realize, all right, it does not help them if I'm constantly doing for them. So to your specific example of schoolwork, yeah, we want parents to care about their kids' education, to be interested in their kids' education, to be involved, to be providing advice and guidance if they're having trouble, you know, to teach, you know, to guide, but not to do their homework for them. In too many communities these days, parents are saying, you know what, I want my kid to get the leg up in the classroom. I want them to get the A, not the B, so I'm going to correct that math problem or that whole math sheet, or I'm going to rewrite the essay, or I'm going to do that science project because, you know, I can really do a good job. The point is, you know, when you show up and do the work your kid is supposed to do, you're sending your kid the message, hey, kid, you're not actually capable without me. It's sort of a kind, loving message, and its intention, I'll always be there for you, is what we intend. But the truth is, it completely undermines their chance to build competency and confidence, not to mention the fact that teachers have no idea what a kid actually knows if the parent is overhelping with the homework. So there's an example there.
Yeah. And as for a specific fix, should I look over my kid's homework and I, you know, let's say I notice that error in the answer supplied to that math problem. Do I then say, hey, take another look at that, or do I just let him get a bad mark?
Oh, worth grade? Well, yeah, you can say, hey, do you want to, this doesn't look right to me. Why don't you take another crack at it? But if your kid says, no, I've done it, I'm sure it's right, you know, there's little point in arguing about that. It's better for your kid then to go into school the next day, turn in that homework, and have the teacher, who's the respected authority in math, you know, say to your kid, hey, you know, let me teach you how to do this. In other words, they have to be, they have to be motivated to do this for themselves. They have to be interested in the learning. And if we just go behind them and correct with a red pen or, you know, an eraser and a pencil, they just don't achieve the learning that is the whole purpose and point of education.
It's a good thing, by the way, that I do not have a child depending on me to look over her math homework.
me too.
Let's go to John in Winchester next. Hi, John.
Hello.
Yes, what is your question or your point?
Well, a few years ago on public television, a speaker talked about the engulfment of a child and explained that was somewhat similar to what's being described, in that fact engulfment of a child was kind of a subtle form of child abuse. And I wonder what your speaker might think of that.
So, is this a form of child abuse?
Well, boy, that's a really big term, John. And, you know, I wouldn't use it lightly. I'm not saying you are, but now that I've written a book on the subject of parenting, I really want to be careful in calling it child abuse. I will say that I think the most the over-directive form of helicopter parenting, the type that says you will become this, you will study this, you must do this activity. You know, I've seen young adults at Stanford, and I've heard that they exist around the nation at every other college. I've seen them wither. I've seen them feel brittle. I've seen them suffer from mental health difficulties. And I think, you know, when you're at that extreme, forcing your kid to basically live a life you've decided, you know, that does to me certainly feel like a form of psychological abuse. You know, there was a young man I write about in my book. He's actually a grown man. He's almost 30. His name's Tyler, and his parents did exactly that, forced him down a particular path. It happened to be law that they favored, and it wasn't until his first year of law school, when his mother was still calling him three times a day, that he finally had the courage to say, and, you know, she'd planned everything, what to do in high school, what to do in college, you know, which law schools to apply to. She decorated his apartment and negotiated the lease with the landlord. She was just standing in the way of him living his own life with the best of intentions. He finally had the courage to say to her, "Mom, your voice is the only voice in my head. I need to hear my own voice." You know, he was a 25, 26-year-old man at the time. And he threw his phone across the room, and he didn't talk to his mom for 6 months. And he said to me, "You know, I've come to appreciate that it's sort of a form of abuse. And at least when you're physically abused, you know, you're at some point you realize you have the right, you know, to say, stop, you know, this is not okay." He said, "But my parents were so loving. They wanted the best for me." He didn't appreciate that it was a form of abuse, really undercutting his mental health until, you know, he was in his mid-20s. So, yeah, John, I mean, I think it's an excellent, it's a delicate point, but I think, you know, yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. So you mentioned, Julie, that you caught yourself cutting the meat of your own, you know, your children who were like 8 and 10 years old. I mean, how did you break out of your tendency, your period of overparenting?
Well, you know, being a freshman dean meant every single fall I welcomed 1,700 new men and women to our campus. And over the years, I got better and better at recognizing that many, many more parents each year were wanting to come and stay, literally or virtually. And, you know, so I could see that precipice of college for my own kids looming. In other words, I could look at my 8 and 10-year-old and say, "Oh, my goodness, in 8 years, one of them's out of the house. In 10 years, the next one's out of the house. How do I let childhood do the work it's supposed to do and prepare them for that inevitable day?" So the first step is just to recognize it. And here are some telltale signs. You got to stop saying "we." If you mean your son is playing soccer, say "my son." Don't say "we're on the soccer team." Don't say "we're doing the science project." Don't say "we're applying to college." If you're saying "we" instead of "my son" or "my daughter," that's a sign mm-hmm. that you're, you know, a little too closely intertwined with their activities and their achievement. The second thing is, you know, if you're arguing with the adults in their lives, if you're constantly taking issues up with the teacher, the principal, the coach, the referee, my goodness, you know, youth sports has become just, you know, a hotbed for this type of overparenting, where we think every single, you know, swing of the baseball bat is a make or break moment. You know, we've got to recognize that these folks are, for the most part, trusted authorities who ought to be trusted to do their job in our kids' lives. And when our kid needs, you know, to say something to these folks, they should say it for themselves. They've got to learn to advocate for themselves. The third thing is, we've got to stop doing their homework. So, you know, if you're saying "we" or you're constantly arguing with adults in their lives or you're doing their homework, you know, those are signs that maybe you're over-involved. And, you know, one of the things my husband and I did right away once I had this aha moment was we realized, you know, our kids don't have any chores. We're constantly, you know, helping them with their life so much. We're so interested in their activities and their play dates and all that. We're not having them help around the house. We treat them like little benevolent tyrants, you know. whenever they want a meal, they get it. You know, we clean up after them. And, boy, we just changed that right away. It was like, "Hey, kids, guess what? It's time to do chores." They said, "What? This is so important. How come we haven't been doing this for years?" And we said, "You know what? You're right. We made a mistake. We should have been teaching you this all along. You know, we've learned our lesson. Now it's time to learn yours." And the implementation of chores, you know, dishes, garbage, recycling, laundry, simple meal making began to turn things around in our household. And, you know, our kids started to develop competencies and capabilities they'd never had. It's all connected. Mm-hmm. One day they're going to be 18 and they're going to need to cross the street by themselves and pump gas and make meals and talk to strangers and, you know, fill out forms and meet deadlines. And, you know, if we just do it for them every step along the way, you know, they'll end up feeble and weak when we need them to be so strong.
Let's go to Sean in Madison next. Hi, Sean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I find kind of what you were just talking about a few minutes ago about striking that balance is, I think, the biggest challenge that I face. I've gone through that transition fairly recently you were just talking about, you know, stopping to take, discontinuing taking care of every little thing for my daughter. She's 7, and helping her to learn chores. But there's a new situation that's come up that I'm just, you know, looking for your views on. There's a new family has moved into the neighborhood, and they have several kids. Most of them are younger than my daughter, and I've made efforts to meet their parents, because the kids are always coming over to our house and want to play in the house, and my instinct is telling me that I should at least know their parents, considering their age, and probably have a contact number. But then I also have that thought of maybe I'm overdoing this a little bit. I mean, my mom didn't know all of my friends' parents when I was a kid, and just want to get your insight on this.
Yeah, do we have to know our kids' friends' parents?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Sean. I think your good instincts are always to be relied on. So there's something in your gut saying, I should probably know this information. Yeah, it's a different time than when you were a child. Also, you know, the context of your neighborhood is the reality in which your kids are being raised. Also, it's a really nice neighborly thing to do to get to know those other parents. So I would say, find a time, you know, maybe the weekend, maybe an evening when you see their car pull up or they're likely to be home, go over, introduce yourself, be the good neighbor, and say, hey, you know, love the fact that your kids are starting to play with mine. That's great. Want to give you my number in case anything comes up, and I'd love to get yours. And then you can say, you know, I don't believe in hovering, but it's always reassuring to know we've got each other's number if we need it. And you can just be very straightforward about that. I think it's actually very responsible and certainly building community these days, you know, where we used to have such a sense of neighborhood. Sociologists are increasingly saying we're losing it in a lot of places in the country. So, you know, by just ringing that doorbell and having that conversation, Sean, you're actually doing some good things, not only for yourself and your daughter, but, you know, for those new neighbors and for your community.
Thank you, Sean, for the call. We are talking with Julie Lithcott-Hames. She is the author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. And our next caller is Jane in La Crosse. Hi, Jane.
Hi. My question is, I just have one child, and I am his playmate. I am, you know, his companion, and we don't have family around where we can get him together with other children. He's 5, so he's just starting kindergarten this year. How do I avoid being a helicopter parent when I pretty much am the only person that can play with him and be his companion? Thank you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for the question. You know, I think this is a great question, and as our kids emerge from toddlers out into tiny little elementary schoolers, their social lives often start to blossom. So I would say when he goes off to kindergarten, that's a perfect time for you to check in with the teacher after the first week or two and say, hey, who does my kid seem to like playing with? And then you can reach out to those parents and say, you know, hey, can we get our kids together to play after school or on the weekend? You know, you want to be fostering the development of friendships and connections with people beyond you. And school sounds like will be a good opportunity for that to happen, since there aren't a whole lot of people around you in your home environment. So good luck with that. I'm excited for your kid. Kindergarten is such an exciting time. And, you know, it might tug on your heartstrings a little bit to go from being his be-all and end-all, his everything, to seeing him, you know, interact with other folks. But that's what you want for him. One day he's going to be this incredibly competent 18-year-old, 20-year-old, 22-year-old man. And, you know, childhood is preparing the way.
Yeah. And I'm wondering what you think. Maybe 5 is young, but maybe Jane can... It doesn't have to be the you know, the only playmate. Maybe her 5-year-old can also sit down with the coloring book by himself. What do you think about?
Yeah, absolutely, Joy. That's an excellent point. Yeah, increasingly, really from toddler years on, kids ought to be given some time, you know, with their toys, with their games, with their puzzles, to be alone, to figure that out. You know, for us to step out of the playroom or the family room or their bedroom or wherever the toys are and to be down the hall and, you know, to check in on them, but to teach them that, hey, I'm not always, you know, right there next to you, but you can count on the fact that I'll always come back. You know, this is what developmental psychologists talk about as kind of how kids develop that sense of self. They need to separate from us and to be reassured that we will always come back. So, yeah, play, mm-hmm. letting your little one play alone for some period of time is a great way, and to continue to lengthen that period of time is a great way to begin fostering more independence.
Jill in Rhinelander is with us. Hi, Jill.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to say, decades ago on the Today Show, there was a child psychologist that was on quite often. His name is Dr. Haim Ganat. He used to say, the hardest part of being a parent is learning how to shove gently, which meant a parent had to help the child develop, make decisions, be able to equip that child to go out on its own when the time came. I mean, you can't just sit back and expect them to develop their skills all by themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, Julie, besides maybe getting the kids involved with chores, as you did, what else do we do to shove gently?
Well, what a great phrase that was. I appreciate that Jill called and said that. And I just want to weigh in on that a little bit. Yes, we must equip our child to go out on his or her own, not leave them alone, you know, not abandon them to fend for themselves. But, you know, really every step of childhood affords a chance for us to teach them this, you know, the skills they're going to need by 18. So shoving gently can really be kind of broken down into four steps. First isn't shoving at all. It's first we do whatever it is for them. Second, then we do it with them. Third, then we watch them do it. And fourth, then they do it on their own. And I think the shove gently is sort of steps three and four. We watch them do it instead of doing it for them. And then they step four, they do it on their own. And this applies, let's just take the example of crossing the street. You know, wherever you live, whatever your community is, you know, there's a street somewhere, and, you know, there's a sense of danger about it, and your kid's got to learn how to navigate that for themselves at some point. So, you know, doing it for them is holding them in your arms and carrying them across the street when they're tiny. Doing it with them means they're able to walk, they're able to hold your hand, you walk with them, you do all the looking back and forth, you decide if it's safe, you know, you nod your head and say, let's go, and all they're doing is walking with you, holding your hand. That's step two. Step three, then you watch them do it, means you're now teaching them, okay, you look both ways to cross the street. And this is what's terrifying for us as parents. You know, what if they don't look hard enough? What if they miss something? I need to be their eyes and ears. Obviously, you're still there to make sure if they've missed something, you can say, wait a minute, hold on. Do you see that down there? You want to, you know, this is the teaching moment, okay? You watch them do it. They decide, okay, it's safe to cross. You know, you nod, yep. And they go and they cross the street by themselves. You're standing on the other side. Step four, they're going to cross that street independently. You're not even there. You're back at home or you're at the office, but you've got trust and confidence that your kid knows how to look both ways to cross the street. Look, this sounds absurdly simple, but if you think about it, there are so many kids today who's between their academics and their extracurriculars and sports, you know, their lives are so consumed by these activities, they're not learning these basic skills around making a meal, pumping gas, talking to a teacher on their own about a concern instead of having mom or dad do it for them, telling the coach they want more playing time. You know, we've really got to appreciate that every single skill that needs to be learned by 18 can be taught in childhood if only we adults will get out of the way and let childhood teach it.
We are talking with Julie Lithcott-Hames. She is a former dean of freshman and undergraduate advising at Stanford University. She has spoken and written widely on the subject of Helicopter Parenting. She is the author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kid for Success. And we are talking about how to do just that, and we are welcoming your questions, maybe some of your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is the author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kid for Success. And we welcome your questions, your examples, maybe challenges for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I asked if you were a helicopter parent during this hour. I asked if you knew someone you would consider a helicopter parent. How about, are you the child of helicopter parents? How's that working for you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And maybe we should, before we go back to the phones, Julie, talk a little bit about what's the big deal if our, you know, if parents are helicoptering after all. All right, you did mention earlier that this is harming kids and that more kids are depressed. College students are depressed today than they have been in the past, and that's certainly a very sad price to pay for helicopter parenting. But what else? What is the harm of helicopter parenting?
Yeah, absolutely, Joy. You know, just on a psychological piece, here's the point. There's this concept in the field of psychology called self-efficacy, which turns out to be really important and really foundational. It's far deeper than self-esteem. It's a sense that I have seen, self-efficacy comes from seeing that my behaviors, my actions, lead to outcomes. And when we parents are kind of that intermediary, you know, forging the path for them, helping them down their path, hovering, you know, taking care of problems, we're depriving them of seeing the results of their own actions and activities, and it turns out to be quite harmful. Other ways in which kids are harmed, they lack basic life skills. You know, I know of college students who just, you know, not beyond the sort of cliche, they don't know how to do their own laundry, which people have been saying for decades, you know, it's they don't know how to fill out forms. Their mom or dad has always done that. They don't know how to keep track of deadlines because mom or dad has always, you know, been up ahead making sure that all deadlines were met. Some kids don't know how to wake themselves up anymore. They're constantly relying on mom or dad to wake them up, you know, to take them to school. You know, if they slept in and didn't make the bus. You know, these are just, you know, when parents do this, of course we're trying to be helpful. You know, we want to be loved and we want to be loving, and we think that helping, you know, is the manifestation of that. And what we're forgetting is at some point our kid needs to know how to, you know, fend for themselves. And so they lack, you know, a set of basic life skills they're going to need out in the world of work or college at 18. In addition to that, there's this really interesting stuff that's emerging from the world of work where employers are saying, you know, more and more millennials, these are people born between 1980 and 2000, don't seem to have that kind of take the initiative skill set that you want in the workplace. They're very good at doing what they've been told to do, which is how their childhood has often been laid out. But when they're given a more wide open situation, they're not very good at anticipating, you know, what next steps are needed in order to achieve a particular outcome. And this is, you know, what I call this overscheduled childhood packed with academics and activities, the checklisted childhood. And this is where the checklisted childhood comes home to roost. They're out there in the workplace and they're just, you know, they say to their employer, just tell me exactly what you want me to do. And they're eager to please and they're eager for approval because, again, everyone gets a trophy generation. But, you know, in that wide open landscape of real life, there often isn't, you know, a clear list to follow for, you know, how to get done what the boss wants to get done. They've got to be able to think for themselves. So here's a great example. Apparently, the folks who hire engineers for NASA Ames and Jet Propulsion Laboratory and Boeing, they're not so interested in the top graduate from the top engineering school they're interested in people who tinkered as a child, who were given the chance to just play with a bunch of stuff and figure stuff out and not have a parent telling them what to do or how to do it. You know, someone who has the hunger, the curiosity to solve problems and use their imagination and creativity, that's what the 21st century workplace is going to need. Those are the jobs, as Dan Pink has said, that don't get outsourced to computers. Well, a checklisted childhood does not lead to greater use of imagination and creativity. It actually just teaches them that someone will always tell them what to do.
So bring back Tinker Toys.
Exactly. You know, Joy, not only Tinker Toys. Remember, Tinker Toys are fabulous. And Lincoln Logs, Lego, such a wonderful, wonderful concept, Lego bricks. Once upon a time, Lego just came in an assortment of colors and sizes. That's a wonderful toy for a kid to play with because they can make anything they want. They can even play with a box. Nowadays, more and more Lego sets are preformed. It's like make a spaceship, make a house, make a castle, and they give you instructions for how to make it, and all you have to do is follow the instructions, and then you say, look, I made it. It's incredibly boring for kids, and it doesn't teach them how to use their imagination. And so, you know, I'm all in favor of the more old-fashioned toys. You know, the less the manufacturer tells a kid what to do with it, the more a kid's imagination and creativity will devise what to do with it.
Well, so should we forget about computer camp and piano lessons and, you know, Little League? Are we supposed to stop structuring our kids with those types of activities?
No, we're not supposed to stop, but here's what we got to do. We've got to pay attention to the kid we actually have. So if your kid's interested in computers, then great. If you can afford computer camp and there's a computer camp near you, send them. And if they want to do it, more importantly, okay, if they like piano, great. You know, we want to provide enrichment. We want to provide them with opportunity. We just don't want to, you know, decide that our child at 5 or 7 or 9 will be, you know, a this or that, you know, a famous tennis player or a famous golfer. You know, and then act as if that's all that matters. We have to constantly be looking to our own child for cues and clues as to what they're actually interested in and support that kid in front of us and being, you know, as strong and as capable at those things as they can be. Do you see the difference? It's
yep.
Like, you know, yeah. We don't just do it. We don't just cram them into a set of activities because, quote unquote, everybody's doing that or because some college apparently wants to see that. Ultimately, our kids will thrive if we love them for who they are, we value, you know, them for who they are, and we, you know, we support them in developing into that best version of their self, rather than, you know, trying to live vicariously. Quite frankly, a lot of parents are saying, well, you know, I want my kid to be or this or that. Often that's our own ego, our own neediness as parents getting in the way of our kids' development. And boy, does that really mess them up down the road.
Let's take some more calls. We have John in La Crosse next. Hi, John.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, John.
Oh, I am enjoying the program a great deal. And I think I understand where she's coming from, but I really, I worked in higher ed also, and what I'm concerned about is the other 50%. These are the kids that are probably going to enter the labor market at $7.25 an hour and so forth, and then we expect them to rise above. We don't live in Lake Wobegon, even though we're close by, but I do think we need to stress the fact that all children are different, and some of these children do not manifest their talents until, well, they never will. But we need to talk about all kids, and we have way too many parents that have no idea what their responsibilities are.
Yeah. So the other end of the spectrum is not parenting enough. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I want to thank John for that call. It's an essential point. And absolutely, the other 50% or whatever percent it is experiencing a different kind of challenge. What I'm talking about in my book is really focused on communities where parents have disposable time and income such that they can spend it hovering over their kids every moment. And that's definitely something the affluent can do, you know, the middle class, the upper middle class. And I completely agree with you that all kids deserve, you know, our care and concern. And all children are different, and they're, you know, if I was on, if I'd written, you know, if this was a different show, we'd be talking about how to get parents who are inclined not to be involved, who aren't familiar with educational opportunities, who aren't, you know, cultivating their kids' options and opportunities at all. We'd want to help those parents understand, you know, be more involved in the classroom and pay attention to whether your kid's getting their homework done and so on. So, yeah, I'm definitely speaking of a particular subset of the population here.
Joanne in Milwaukee joins us now. Hi, Joanne.
Good morning. Within the past half year or so, there was a case out in on the West Coast. I don't remember if it was Seattle or someplace in Oregon, but a couple was arrested because they allowed their, I think it was 9 and 10-year-olds, to walk a mile home from something by themselves, and somebody saw these kids walking, called the police, and Child Protective got involved. The parents had the children taken away from them.
Yeah, and you know what, Joanne, just because we're so short on time, we did do something on this. It was actually, that was a Baltimore case. There was a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, I think. But in any case, that brought up the debate over free-range parenting and whether we should be doing that instead. Julie, what do you think? I mean, do we want to go back to free-range parenting?
Here's the point. At some point, kids need to go to the park and walk down the street and go to school on their own. We can't always do it. So the question is, in each community, what's appropriate? If we keep in mind we're supposed to be building their skills, not completely preventing them from being out in the world, at some point we have to let them out. I think this is a subject on which both conservatives and liberals can agree in this country. Perhaps the only thing that, you know, when police are getting involved, the government's getting involved in, you know, our decision as parents about whether my kid has the skill set and mindset to walk to the park and back alone, that's kind of terrifying. Obviously, we want to look out for kids, but I'd rather the police be catching the bad guys than, you know, escorting a 9 or 10-year-old back home when no harm came to them whatsoever.
Yeah, Lori emails, what's the best way to respond to a close friend or family member who is a helicopter parent? Obviously, this would vary depending on the relationship and the individual, but is there a best practice to follow to influence the parent to have a more hands-off approach?
Yeah, you know, Lori, thanks for the question. The last couple chapters of my book, How to Raise an Adult, I talk about daring to parent differently. The first chapter there is reclaim yourself, and then the second chapter is be the parent you want to be. And in the book, I have something called simple scripts for complicated moments. So when you see somebody trying to referee child's play, or when they're chauffeuring their kid everywhere, or when they're fetching and caring for their kid, or acting as their personal assistant, or doing their homework, whatever it is, I've got some scripts in here where you can basically say what you believe without sounding, you know, like you're nosy or judgmental. So, you know, there's a movement afoot to swing the parenting pendulum back away from overparenting, Lori, and it sounds like you want to join it, which is awesome. Check out Simple Scripts for Complicated Moments on page 287 of How to Raise an Adult.
Yeah, so as voices like yours keep speaking up, do you think we are seeing overparenting, the phenomenon of helicopter parenting, turning around now?
Joy, I certainly hope so, and I'll tell you what, however strong my own voice may be, the strongest voice comes from those who've been overparented. I'm hearing from more and more young people who will write to me or do a, you know, call in on a show like this and say, you know what, I think I was raised this way. What do I do? And, you know, I really feel for those young adults because they're hungry to make something of themselves. They want to be successful. You know, they want to make it in the world. And they realize they've had too much done for them, and they're just not aware enough of themselves or their environment or what it takes to succeed in the world without mom or dad helping. So their voice will be the strongest. And fortunately, they'll be a loud voice because there are lots of them out there, the great millennial generation, hungry to have the chance to be the adults we'll need them to be if only we'll let them.
It sounds like another radio show. Thanks very much for being with us. Julie Lithcott-Hames is a Middleton, Wisconsin native and the author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Elizabeth Delaquest for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
A big thank you to our sustaining members. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and with your reliable monthly support, great music, fascinating conversations, and important news, have a secure home on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're not sure what the next step is in supporting the radio you love, encourage a friend to make the same kind of convenient monthly gift that you do. Thanks for your support and for spreading the word.